PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Philip Deaver is our guest this afternoon. His latest book, How Men Pray, is a collection of poetry. He is also the author of a collection of short stories, Silent Retreats. A winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction, Deaver was born in Chicago. He grew up in the Douglas County community of Tuscola, and many of his stories are set in central Illinois. He's back in the area for a visit, and this evening he'll be at Pages for All Ages for a reading and book signing. The event at the bookstore in Savoy, just south of Champaign, is set for 7:30 this evening. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation this afternoon. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Philip Deaver is Associate Professor of English and Writer-in-Residence at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida. Prior to joining the faculty at Rollins, he worked as a senior consultant for the national consulting firm Wilson Learning Corporation. He has held fellowships from the National Endowment of the Arts and the Breadloaf Writers Conference. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Philip Deaver, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
What's it like being back in your old stomping grounds?
I get back every couple of years, it seems like, and it's really great. It's particularly nice this year because is spring early or
yeah.
is it?
We've had a really warm spring.
It's gorgeous out there.
Yes, it is beautiful. So you get back fairly often?
Fairly often, every couple of years. The last time I was here was for an opening of Gus's Candy Store down in the reopening of it down in Tuscola in November, I believe it was.
Mm. What was it like growing up in Tuscola?
Well, it's a small town, and my father was a doctor there, so it seemed like everything was connected to everything else there. Everybody knew everybody, and I think most of us who knew each other then still know each other. If we're not in touch, it takes about a minute to get in touch when we see each other. It seems almost like nothing's lost with the passage of time. The connections were so good in the first place.
Yeah. And how does the landscape look to you? You know, Florida is such a different kind of place.
I love the flatland. And actually, Florida is awfully flat itself. So it just looks gorgeous to me. It looks like home. It just looks like mm-hmm. home. This is the center for me. And everything else is interesting. Mountains, ocean, tropical weather. That's all very interesting to me. But this is the center of me.
Yeah. It's a landscape I think that grows on you.
Yes.
You know?
The only thing is winter. I really don't find myself drawn back to winter
no.
at all. Although it seems like ever since I left, you stopped having the winters I fled.
Yeah, it's been pretty mild, pretty mild. Well, speaking of the landscape, maybe you would read a poem that says landscape to me from your collection, How Men Pray, and that is The Vanishing Point. You want to start there?
Okay. The this is for an artist in the Winter Park area who paints and really showed me what the sort of techniques of painting are and what the craft is about in a way. And that's where the term, the vanishing point, comes from. So this is the vanishing point. See how the lines of this picture seem to pull the two figures along a rail receding to the distance. See how the trees and rocks along the Colorado River, too, are pulled. It's a long shot, so there's depth, panorama, and vast opportunity. My dad's hand is on my shoulder, but can't remain there, and I'm too young to know it. See the way his eyes stare into the camera? He's waiting for the flutter behind the lens that signals the moment is over. Family vacation, 1963, a year before the wreck. And even today I feel that hand on my shoulder, not as in a dream or my imagination, but in the most real of ways. In the rigid zone that is the difference between photograph and reality, I look for the ghost of some hovering premonition we hadn't noticed before, a predictive configuration in the clouds, or a warning in the haze and shadow in the trees, or in the flash of the river passing just behind us. What I find is what we find in any picture locked in these dimensions, the vanishing point, operating on us both and equally, like gravity and that day's now forgotten weather, pulling us away from there and then and here and now, toward a small hole in the firmament where even a couple of guys running all too parallel might, and this is a real long shot, meet again.
A vanishing point. Autobiographical?
Yes. My father was killed in a car wreck in 1964 on the First Street Road just south of Tolono, along with my grandfather, both in the same wreck. It was a very big deal when a kid 17 and my sister 15. But, you know, it was the big tragedy that we had in our family, and it sort of set everybody off in some direction they hadn't predicted. This is one of the things I'm really aware of, is the fact that everybody has these. Everybody has that bad thing that happened that sent them whirling some direction they hadn't thought that they would go. And that was ours.
Yeah. Well, I love those lines. My dad's hand is on my shoulder, but it can't remain there. And I'm too young to know it. And hopefully, you know, now that we're older, we know that these moments are just that, so precious.
Yeah, a very rich moment, being out there on a family vacation, just us all isolated and enjoying one another. Yeah, that vacation turned out to be the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah. I remember an uncle of mine saying upon my marriage, "Well, how long do you two think you'll be together?" And I'm like, "What? Pardon me?" And what he meant was, of course, you never know what's going to happen. Take good care of one another.
Right. Enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
And square everything away.
Yeah.
Keep squared away with those people that you might lose.
Yeah. Another poet who was a guest here a few months back said, this was one of the observations she made about poetry, it emphasizes the moment and the minute.
I think that's the great thing about it. As a short story writer, which is what I would probably be classified as, poetry is a very friendly form for me, because it's even it's really the same kind of narrative and story, only you're even more economical with the language, and the frame you put around the moment is even smaller.
When did you begin writing?
I wrote from the time I was in the sixth grade, and I've written steadily ever since, but I didn't publish until I was 40.
Wow. What led you to make that step then at that point?
I always think I knew I would publish, but I wasn't very good for a long time. I'm not so much of a scholar. I'm more, I sort of arrived at this by continuing to try to do it. And that's how long it took me to get any good at it.
Well, you're pretty damn good at it, Mr. Deaver. Do you have a memory of a moment, a time when you were aware of the power of a good story?
Yes, I always thought one of the things that I always wanted to do with stories was create in readers the effect that certain stories created on me. And so the stories that really resonated with me, I would really look at them and study them to try to understand why it is that really touched me. And then I would try to write my own kinds of stories that were timed and balanced to touch readers in that same way.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've enjoyed about the stories in Silent Retreats is that they have me holding my breath. You know, what's going to happen? And you take us on some great twists and turns, and, you know, they can feel like taking, you know, those S-curves in the road from Tuscola to Arcola in Arcola Girls.
During the time my dad was a doctor in Tuscola, an awful lot of his living was made on the car wrecks that happened on Highway 45, which is kind of ironic for what happened to him. But I do remember that the road south of Tuscola flooded. I think it was because of the rise that made the railroad. And so the drainage was thrown off, and so people would hit deep lakes of water over the highway in heavy rain, and just hydroplane. So they made curves to get a little further away from the railroad and get the drainage a little bit better around the highway, and then people died in the curves. So. I like that. I mean, I like that sort of analogy for an awful lot of things. Somehow, sometimes the remedy that we arrive on to solve a problem brings with it its own equal or even greater problems.
Yeah. And these stories in Silent Retreats, I mean, truly, I didn't know where you were taking me. So thank you for that.
Well, we always say in writing, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And so sometimes I didn't know where we were going either till we got there.
I was going to ask you that, you know, do you find yourself surprised at the turns a story can take?
That's part of the fun of writing, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Would you share an example of how you started a story and thought you were headed in one direction and found yourself off in another direction or completely turned around?
I sure can. For one thing, that is the exact experience of almost every story I write, one way or the other. Very rarely does a story arrive of a piece and I sort of know where it's going and then I accomplish that by writing it. Most of the time, no matter what I think it's going to do, a character will take over or will divert the story in a different direction. Or a character will insist himself to a more prominent role than my original plan in the story had taken. And in my short story collection, I have a character named Skidmore who was, I call him an occasional character because in many of my stories, the story wasn't about him, but whoever the story was about, Skidmore would call him up and sort of inject himself into the story. So finally, it became clear that I was going to have to write an entire story about Skidmore. Skidmore, I didn't want to do that, but Skidmore became a character, developed his own reality, and pushed himself on me. That's the way that worked.
Yeah. There's a character in the story, is it How It Was I Shacked Up with Martha?
Why I Shacked
Why
Up with Martha.
Why I Shacked Up with Martha.
When
and
I was
he's
in...
quite a character. And I like him very much. And he seems to me to be, you know, if somehow you could, maybe I should go back and reread the Rabbit books, but he seems to be a much more human Harry Engstrom kind of guy.
He is. He is very like Harry Engstrom. He might be like Harry Engstrom in the first stages. When he finally realized how wild it was going to get.
Wow.
But that story's, the background on that story is that I was in college in a Catholic school in northwestern Indiana, St. Joseph's College, and I was the editor of the literary magazine. And it was noted that none of the guys, it was a guy's school, none of the guys would read the literary magazine. They just weren't interested in it. We were all literary. Most of them were all jocks, and just the twain didn't meet. So I was putting together the literary magazine in my senior year, and I wrote a story called Why I Shacked Up with Martha, just because the title I knew would provoke a readership in the spring at St. Joseph's College, and it sure did.
Yeah.
And then years later, because I liked the title, I abandoned the original kind of undergraduate story and wrote a different, more adult story under the same title.
Yeah. That's interesting. When do you know you're finished with a short story or a poem, or is it more it's finished with you?
It's when it's published.
Okay. And it's on the page.
Before it's published, it's not set in concrete, and it just it remains liquid instead of solid until somebody else sets the type.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the collection of poetry, How Men Pray. What would you like to say about it to people who are listening this afternoon who haven't yet picked it up?
Well, this is, I believe, typical contemporary poetry. It isn't rhyming poetry. It isn't what you would call verse. It's narrative poetry. In the tradition, but of course I don't presume to anything else except the tradition of Robert Frost and poems like Out, Out and Stopping by a Snowy Wood. He's got a very natural kind of use of the language that doesn't invert the sentence so that it will achieve a rhyme, but it's more natural to our way of talking. So sometimes people will come to me and they'll say, well, you know, why is this a poem? It doesn't rhyme and so on. But my answer to that is I think you can tell a poem when you see one. And could I read one that I said that my grandfather died in the same car wreck as my father in 1964. And my grandfather gave me a typewriter when I was in the sixth grade, which I used to begin writing. And this is for my grandfather and about him, but it's really sort of about his typewriter because he did two things. He gave me a typewriter and he also gave me a magnifying glass. So one day I decided to look at this old typewriter with his old magnifying glass. And the title of the poem is Corona. You know, it's like Smith Corona, the typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Corona. This morning I've taken my grandfather's magnifying glass and through it eyed in specific the edges and stared into the metallic black and closely noticed the archaic curves and followed the rigid up-down vintage old gold decal across the face of his typewriter. Corona. Everything's big, and the smell of the oil is still there and the metal filings from the wear. Never mind what I was looking for. Key by key I looked. The E and D were worn, but the space bar had an indention from a quadrillion light touches of the thumb, as though space was what we needed most. I climbed higher, found the carriage, huge like a train parked on a siding. Then from there I could see into the open well, the dark ribbon and armatures and linkages, the mysterious action, shift, and slide, gray metal and inner workings, a perfect extension of my grandfather's long-deceased desire to express himself. Enormous, like staring into a cooled-down crater and seeing far below a whole factory occupying the center of the earth.
Corona. I remember those old typewriters.
They were beautiful.
Yeah. They're like little pieces of sculpture.
They really were. And when you looked at them close and saw all their little parts out of the context of the bigger piece, they were fascinating. It just throws you back to the 20s and the 30s and the metal that things were made of and the smell of oil. It was great.
Yeah, and the ribbon had a smell.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, yeah. My parents had a portable Royal, and it was wonderful. They were such great typists. They could fly, you know. And today, you know, we don't really have an appreciation for that. We have laser printers. And
that's right.
It's like I have no idea what goes on in that box.
No, that's right. It's invisible now.
Yeah, yeah. So what else did you do with your grandfather's magnifying glass?
I carried it with me everywhere I've been, and every place I needed a magnifying glass, my grandfather's was there. It was a beautiful old thing, big Bausch and Lomb with a light on the back of it so it could really light what you were looking at. I don't need any other magnifying glass.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Philip Deaver. He's a native of Chicago. He was born in Chicago, but he grew up in the Douglas County community of Tuscola, and many of his stories are set in central Illinois. He's back in the area for a visit, and this evening he'll be at Pages for All Ages for a reading and a book signing. The event at the bookstore in Savoy is set for 7:30 this evening, the 19th of April. Philip Deaver is Associate Professor of English and Writer in Residence at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the conversation this afternoon with the telephone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, you began writing stories in the sixth grade. When did you begin writing poetry?
I think probably in the 1970s. After I got back from the service, I was working in little jobs trying to launch a career some way. And I was a little bit more stretched for time, and I didn't really have time figured out. So the writing that I did were these small scrambled little shreds of things, and I began just sort of working on them and shaping them into small statements and small kind of evocations. And that's how I arrived on poetry. And then it was about the late 70s that I began to really read the new contemporary poets and meet some of them and really sort of understand then what poetry is like in this time. And then I just began to compile them. And I would send them off from time to time and get a few of them published. But for the most part, I didn't have an idea of a book until fairly recently.
Mm. When you started, were there certain themes, certain problems, certain issues that you were investigating through poetry?
No. I stayed very autobiographical, and that was the difference between the poetry and the short stories. Most of my prose is, it's got an echo of autobiography, but it's set in a matrix of fiction. And my poems are pretty, frankly, autobiographical. And in my next collection of poems, I'm beginning to work on another set, won't be autobiographical. What I've learned from this set, I'm going to go another step and also go a different direction with poems.
Yeah.
These, for instance, these poems have been written over 20 years. The next set of poems will have been written over a couple of years. So there's less of a stretch of my own personal history in there. And I'm gonna go more into observing the world than sort of monitoring my own heartbeat like I did with How Men Pray.
Yeah. Is that something, as professor of English now at Rollins College, you're able to do, you know, because I believe now you're on sabbatical?
Right.
So that's got to be a great gift for a writer.
It is a spectacular gift. And it's particularly a gift for somebody who has gotten to be my age and never had one before. If you became a college professor when you were 29 instead of when you were 52, it's you might get several sabbaticals in your life, but this is my first, and I am enjoying it. But there's an awful lot of writing going on, and it's the first time that I've ever really been paid to write. So
that's great. You know, we have on the faculty here at Illinois, we have some really fine writers as well. I think we're blessed to have them, and they're not only great writers, but they're great guests. They come and visit us here on the program. And we have a listener who is joining us now on the telephone, I believe, from Washington, Illinois, line one. Good afternoon. And let's try one more time here. Do we have a listener there waiting for us on line one? Hello? No, somehow or other we've lost the call. Please give us a call. Give us a call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I believe our listener is calling back. I'm getting a signal here to hold on just a second, and we'll get our listener on the air, I hope, fingers crossed, to speak with Philip Deaver. Good afternoon. Hello? Line one? No, I don't know. Maybe we can give the phone system a go over here this afternoon, because it'd be a shame to miss a call this afternoon. So let's get our Let's get our technical directors here, Jason Croft in Master Control and Henry Frain here with us in Studio A this afternoon on the story, and we'll get some calls in this afternoon for Philip Deaver. One of the things that I was amazed at by looking at your website, philipdeaver.com, is
philipfdeaver.com.
Okay, thank you. philipfdeaver.com is the number of projects you have underway. Are these things that are all going on at the same time?
Yes, in various stages. Some just started, some just wrapping up. Publication, especially publication of books, has never been easy for me. And as a result, novels that I've been writing over the years sort of stay in a liquid state until they're published, and some of them haven't been yet. So I'm constantly in a state of keeping those projects alive. And But what you see on the website is not even old novels being kept alive. There's a new novel. There's a short story collection. Yeah, and there's a baseball anthology. So there's a lot going on. And it's really thrilling. And when you stop and think about it, a sabbatical is about the only time you can carry that kind of a load.
Yeah. Well, when will we see Past Tense, this novel?
I don't know. I hope it's within 18 months.
That'd be terrific. I know that listeners in the area would probably be very interested in seeing it because, according to the description, this is a novel pulling together many of the characters in silent retreats.
Right. I took several of them. There were a couple of new characters that arrived after Silent Retreats, the story collection. But most of them are all tangled up in one big book in Past Tense.
Yeah. The characters of Silent Retreats, you couldn't just leave them there, huh?
No, they stay with you. They're it's not quite like they're your own children, but they are they are three-dimensional characters by the time I'm done thinking about them, and they just don't pass on. They, as I said, they keep insisting themselves into the next work.
Yeah. Could you give us a sense of what it is, where you begin to create a character, or how it is that the character begins to take shape?
When I'm working on a character, for starters, my stories are character-centered. So when we talk about stories, stories for me are really what a person did. They don't have so much to do with some kind of a plot line, but more what a person did and how other people responded to it. And so out in the wild of our lives, I'll spot something that is a thing a person has done that has had these ramifications out into his or her world. And that's how I start to see the story.
Mm. And the process for beginning a poem, anything at all similar?
Sometimes a first line, sometimes a little event that has happened to me that I feel is a little, that is just a sign or a signal or something a little bit bigger, really, than just the event itself. And when I can spot something like that, I might scratch something down, a line or two right there at the time that I experience it, and then go back to it and see if I can fashion something out of it. For every one poem that appears in a book like this, there are 15 dead ends and starts that just don't gel.
Yeah. Would you like to read another poem?
Yes, let's see here. The poem Wounded Knee comes from a trip through South Dakota that I took. Much of my family lives in South Dakota and western Nebraska. And I just happened to take a trip by myself from Winter, South Dakota, across the Pine Ridge Reservation back to western Nebraska. And I was driving across that reservation and I saw a sign that said Wounded Knee, 12 miles. And how are you going to drive by something like that? So I went up to Wounded Knee, and I was the only person there besides a fellow who was down at a little tourist site selling dream catchers. And so I wrote Wounded Knee. I send this to you who don't hear me by normal means and who will never read it. From this hill where I, the traveler, stand, where our warring ancestors are buried. I send it down toward you from the arched iron gate of the white man's cemetery, down the hill to the rough roadside lean-to where on this day, with a storm looming dark blue beyond the upwind bluffs, you sit alone, eagle feather in your hair, selling dream catchers to tourists, if only there were any. Catch this. Even Anglo-honky white boys from Illinois live with stuff. I'm sorry. I send this down the long grassy slope to the road, across the powdery dirt made up of your dead prairie people, the slaughtered buffalo, the dead eagle. I send it to you into the shadows of your shelter where you sit staring up at me. I send it to you some other way than calling to you. Stormy day daydream, rolling rock, mental telepathy, smoke signals, the posture of how men pray.
Mm. Wounded Knee, Philip Deaver. Let's talk with a listener. Let's try again. And a caller is waiting for us on line 4 in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. A nice poem. I'm glad things are working again. At least I got through.
okay.
I sort of want a sort of off-the-wall question. If you want to answer it, fine. If not, you know, I understand, because I'm just as much interested in listening to you talk as listening to you answer a question for me. But I was wondering, since you've published and are, you know, sort of writer in progress, how much attention in between the times you're not actually writing, do you pay attention to what I'll call, whatever it is, your tradition? And I'm thinking in the large sense, the Midwest, and before you said most of your family lived out in Dakotas and Nebraska, I was, you know, thinking you purely, you know, an Illinois boy. But I guess that's not particularly true. But I'd wondered, you know, in terms of the other people that, you know, the canonical people, you know, like, you know, Hemingway, of course, and other people from the Midwest, both poets and novelists, I was wondering, do you ever saturate yourself in what they did and what you're doing? And thanks a lot.
Great question, and yes, and I am an Illinois boy. I was born and raised here. My family came here from Nebraska, and so we would always haul back there for family vacations. But my people and or my generation of the family is here in Illinois. So that's a good point. I probably confused matters by saying that about Nebraska, and yes, I'm an Illinois boy, and I've always noticed the honored the tradition of the doctor's son, Ernest Hemingway, in Oak Park, Illinois, and studied his work and followed him, followed his biographies and so on. Yes, I've really gone after that, but also the contemporary short story writers, as you say, the canonical folks, you know, that include Raymond Carver and Ann Beadia. These people are the types that I have aspired to be among. I'm not there, but I'm most interested in their kind of work. So I've observed it, and we have a saying in writing poetry that for every poem you write, you should read 20. And I guess I say that about short stories, too. For every story you write, you should really read the fine short story writers and steep yourself and your sensibilities in the tradition that they've built. And so I, in answer to your question, I have observed and really taken a long career bath in the work of all these people and tried to embrace being influenced by, not copy them, but just allow that influence because it's a good one.
Hmm. Philip Deaver, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we didn't get that first caller on the air. However, Jason Croft and Master Control wrote it out. And the caller's question, the caller comments, when he was young, there was a difference between poetry and prose. Poetry rhymed. When and why did this change?
Okay. Well, when he was young, the poetry that he was looking at may have rhymed. But there was a huge tradition coming along of poetry that didn't, going all the way back to a lot of the work of Ezra Pound and certainly T.S. Eliot. There's a poem by Robert Frost called Out, Out, which is a purely narrative poem about a tragedy in which a little kid at a sawmill, I believe, has his arm cut and dies. The poem is called Out, Out, and it sort of started a narrative poetry tradition. And this poem goes way back. So I don't know how old the caller was, mm-hmm. but there's been a long tradition of non-rhyming free verse and blank verse type of poetry that's run right along with the other. And I'll just say that I do like rhyme sometimes, and maybe even in the poems that you heard me read, there is what I call occasional rhyme. But I try not to let the rhyme dominate my my language so that I would reverse the verb and the noun in a sentence in order to allow it to rhyme, or in some other way do a contortion or somersault with our natural language in order to make a rhyme. I would far rather get it set exactly the way I want to rather than let that rhyme flip me around. And the answer to that, of course, for those who favor rhyme will say, well, the masters could achieve exactly what they wanted to achieve with rhyme. True.
Yeah. I wonder if our expectation for rhyme is because, as you say, that's the poetry we were exposed to when we were kids. And when I was growing up, I don't know what the situation is today, but we were expected to commit poetry to memory. And the rhyming, perhaps our teachers thought it would be easier, and it probably is easier to commit a poem to memory if it rhymes.
I think so. I have a hard time committing anything to memory. And so I'm not aided by rhyme. So it's, but there may be some people that really find that helpful. You know, I can remember back trying to be in plays in college, and that was my horror, was the remembering lines. I don't remember my own poems.
Yeah, well, it is wonderful, though, if you're in the company of someone who is able to do that, isn't it? It's a wonderful entertainment.
I've seen poets come on, or Lawrence Ferlinghetti a few years ago, saw him read, and he stood right up and just did an hour-long reading, basically performing, and he was great. He said, you don't perform poetry sitting down. And then he told the audience, also, you don't listen to it sitting down. And so everybody stood.
Well, that's interesting. I don't recall the poet now who said, I write my poems so that they will be sung or performed. I don't recall. See? I can't do it either.
Well, that would be a philosophy of Ferlinghetti, whose music was sort of jazz related, and you know, he tied his poetry to music.
Yeah, well, in old recordings of poets, there is kind of a, sometimes you get that singing feeling, and now I can't recall the poet, native of Springfield, Illinois, but anyway, I've heard him reading poetry on an old recording, and he essentially is almost singing it.
I've heard recordings of Dylan Thomas that were almost like high rhetoric or high rhetorical deliveries, almost like a preacher, thrilling to listen to, but entirely different from me.
Yeah, exactly. As a professor of English now at Rollins College, do you teach a course or courses on poetry?
Yes, I teach the writing of poetry, which is probably three-quarters a reading of good poets. And then also, you know, of course, their writing. But we're doing that formula I told you about a moment ago of reading a lot of poetry to sort of educate the ear to the writing of it.
Yeah.
And then I also teach poetry as literature, where it's not a creative writing class, it's more.
Yeah. When you read a poem for the first time with your students, how do you approach it? Do you dive right in? Do you introduce it? How do you approach it?
I have them read it several times, and then we talk about what they're getting out of it as it stands without background or introduction or anything. And once they understand it and have gotten all they can get out of it as it stands, then we'll start to talk about the background of it and what it was that sort of germinated this poem for the author. In the end, all that matters is the work, what it is that's on the page. But from the standpoint of people that want to write, they need to know what it is that causes this particular kind of a poem to happen so they can begin to spot the causes in their own lives and do their own writing.
Yeah. I've often wondered, you know, why aren't there artists' notes that accompany books of poetry?
I think in some ways there are many poets who resist explaining, trying to explain. But by the same token, in current, the last 20 years or so, there's been a new turn toward having the poetry more accessible. And a perfect example of that is our former poet laureate, Billy Collins, who's quite accessible and still right in the heart of the contemporary poetry movement.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Here we are in April. It's National Poetry Month. And as I understand it, it's the largest celebration of the arts in America, which says something.
That's a happy thing.
Yeah. Also, if you're interested, listeners, in poetry, tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus 580, David Inge will talk with Linda Beards, who's a poet and professor of English at the University of Washington. So, and Philip Deaver has been our guest this afternoon. I'm sorry we have to wrap it up. It's just been a pleasure speaking with
Celeste,
you.
Celeste, thanks
afternoon.
Very much for having me today.
Philip Deaver has been my guest. He's the author of a new collection of poetry, How Men Pray. He's also the author of a collection of short stories, Silent Retreats. And this evening, he will be at Pages for All Ages for a reading and book signing. The event at the bookstore in Savoy is set for 7:30 this evening. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. What a day it was on the Chicago Board of Trade. We begin by taking a look at the outside market, where we saw the Commodity Research Bureau Index up 6.26 today to 303.95, that bringing index money back into the commodity markets. As we look at the particulars, we'll see buy stops hit, prepaid buy stops hit across the complexes, those triggering prices up higher. And it was a sharp incline indeed, particularly in that soybean pit, where we saw increases of more than 20 cents, bringing us to highs that are actually, well, 2.5 week highs, the last time we've seen prices at this level. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars, which we'll be talking about later, with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out in New Market, Indiana. He'll be joining us at 2:06 on the closing market report. May wheat, a high on the day of 308 and a quarter, a low of 302 and a half, settling 308, up 6 and a quarter. July, a high of 318, a low of 312 and a quarter, settling 317 and three quarters, up 6 and a half. September, a high of 325, a low of 321 and a quarter, settling 324 and three quarters, up 7. December, a high of 335 and a half, a low of 329 and a half, settling 334 and a half, up 6 and a quarter. And March, a high of 344, a low of 340 and a half, settling 343, up 6 on the day. May corn, a high of 210, a low of 205, settling 209 and a half, up 5 and a quarter. July, a high of 218 and a quarter, a low of 213, settling at 217 and three quarters, up 5 and a quarter. September, a high of 225, a low of 220 and a quarter, settling 224 and a half, up 4 and three quarters. December, a high of 234, a low of 222 and a half, settling 233, up 4 and a half. March, a high of 240 and three quarters, a low of 237, settling 240, up 4 and a half. May, a high of 244 and a half, a low of 241 and three quarters, settling 244, up 4 and a quarter. May oats, a high of 154 and a half, a low of 153, settling 154 and a quarter, up 1 and a half. July, a high of 153, a low of 151, settling 152, up three quarters on the day. May soybeans, a high of 632, a low of 613 and a half, settling 631, up 21 and a half. July, a high of 640, a low of 621, settling 639, up 22 and three quarters. August, a high of 638, a low of 619 and a half, settling 637 and a quarter, up 22 and three quarters. September, a high of 632, a low of 615, settling 631 and a half, up 25 and a quarter. November, a high of 629 and a half, a low of 610, settling 629, up 25 and a quarter. January, a high of 630, a low of 613, settling 629 and a quarter, up 24 and a quarter. May soybean meal, a high of 195, a low of 188, settling 194.90, up 7.90. July, a high of 195.90, a low of 188, settling 195.70, up 8.80. May soybean oil, a high of 22.98, a low of 22.37, settling 22.83, up 56. July, a high of 22.15, a low of 22.58, settling 23.08, up 63 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where we saw some strong gains in the lean hog pit today, Celeste.
That's right. July lean hogs up a dollar today. April feeders is where we'll start. The high price today, 111.40. The low, 110.65. The settlement, 110.85. That finished off 55. May feeders, 107.90. The high, 107.25. The low, 107.52.5. The settlement, that up 20. August feeder cattle, 108.65. The high, the low, 107.60. The settlement, 108.40. That up 15. April live cattle, 90.75. The high, 90.02.5. The low, 90.55. The settlement, that up 62.5. June live cattle, 85.45. The high, 84.52.5. The low, finishing at 85.40, up 85. May lean hogs, 75.20. The high, 74.05. The low, the settlement, 75.15. That up 60. June, 77.75. The high, 76.20. The low, the settlement, 77.67.5. That up 97.5. July, 78 even. The high, 76.40. The low, 77.90. The settlement, that up $1. August lean hogs, 75.65. The high, 74.35. The low, the settlement, 75.57.5. That up 72.5. May bellies finish lower today. The high 86 even, the low 83.30. The settlement 85.95. That down 27.5. The Dow is up 68 points, the NASDAQ 17 higher, and the S&P 500 up 8.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for community, life sciences, and workplace clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Oliver Grouse from Carnation, Washington writes, "Dear Dr. Science, we recently purchased a new clothes dryer. Our old machine bore the admonition, 'Clean lint filter before each use.' This new machine says, 'Clean lint filter after each use.' What's going on here?"
One of those machines was manufactured south of the equator. There, you have to do everything backwards, or else the center doesn't hold. Everything flies apart. Not only do your clothes not get clean, you wind up with somebody else's laundry. It's vitally important that you follow the directions. People like you are responsible for most of the evil in the world today. Every once in a while, you get some bozo who tries to program his VCR without reading the directions first.